chairman said there is a paper, a presentation paper, a paper to support this presentation, I think is available outside. It just gives some technical facts and figures to support what I'm going to say tonight. What I'm going to say tonight is I'm going to concentrate on the operational aspects of submarines used in the dockyard. I'll skip over the radioactive materials and the processes actually undertaken by DML in refitting and particularly in refueling the submarines. What I'd like to talk about is the area in which the Royal Navy operates its submarines, bringing the submarines under nuclear power into the dockyard, operating them in the dockyard, and then after they've been refitted and refueled, undertaking testing, what's called power range testing, inside the dockyard. So we're looking at operational nuclear submarines. And I'll be relating that to these new regulations, the Radiation Emergency Preparedness and Public Information Mouthful Regulations, REPA, not REPIER, but REPA is what they're called. And these were published about 6 years ago, a European directive, and have been slowly and somewhat belatedly introduced into the UK. Now, by September 20th, local authorities, the nub of this is local authorities will have to assume responsibility for off-site emergency planning in the event of a radiological incident, unless they've been, once they've been informed by the health and safety executive. In fact, if the health and safety executive doesn't inform them 6 months prior to September 20th, they have 6 months thereafter. Now, as it stands, Plymouth City Council have yet to receive its notification. But let's just go through these regulations. What it is, it's a relationship between the local authority, the operator, the Royal Navy, and DML, and the health and safety executive. It's this sort of relationship where these three parties get together to produce an off-site plan. And tucked inside is a public consultation phase. And the regulations say you only have opportunity to consult with the local authority if the local authority deems that person, that body, to be appropriate to consult with. So it's not an automatic right of consultation. The local authority have to deem you to be appropriate. The way in which this works in practice is the Royal Navy produces an operator's on-site plan. What does it do in an emergency on the dockyard? And then it prepares a report of assessment that's sent to the HSC that should identify the hazards, what type of nuclear reactors and weapons, etc., you have in the dockyard and the approaches, and what's the risk. The HSC then look at that and they tell Plymouth City Council or local authority whether they need to, A, put in place an emergency plan, and critically important, what sort of area that plan should cover. And then the local authority, Plymouth and a few other locals, have to prepare what's called an off-site plan. That's how you look after members of the public against radiation exposure, how you limit the consequences of exposure in the off-site area. And I want to look at three documents: the report of assessment, the emergency area definitions, and DEBPUB safety, present off-site plan. And just to sum up, the report of assessment, we'll be asking questions like, does the report of assessment include all possible accidents and incidents? And of course, after September the 11th, we now have to take into account terrorist attack, or do we? We'll be looking at the emergency area, and I'll be asking the question, is the emergency area defined by the Health and Safety Executive, yet to be defined, will it be large enough? And finally, for the City of Plymouth and the neighbouring local authorities, will the off-site plan, can it cope? And will you be shown how it can cope? So when will it consult with you? Again, just to sum those up, does the report of assessment include all possible accidents? Is the emergency plan area large enough? And can Plymouth City Council cope? Well, we don't know, because each and every one of these is not yet available. Remember, the deadline is September the 20th. They can delay so long as the health and safety delay in the notification. So 6 months from once the health and safety executive have said, go for it. Nothing available yet. But I can look at the report of assessment. What I expect to find in the report of assessment, it shall identify all the hazards. The hazards are things like nuclear reactors, conventional weaponry, nuclear weaponry, and the risks. How often would you expect a nuclear reactor to go bang? How frequently would you expect a torpedo to go pop, etc.? So would the Ministry of Defence's report of assessment that goes to the HSE, would that provide those sort of details? Well, hazards on a nuclear-powered submarine are the conventional weaponry, the torpedoes, the harpoons, etc. Obviously, the nuclear weapons, if they're carrying nuclear weapons, the nuclear reactor inside each submarine, and, of course, the radioactive waste and fuel stored in the actual refit facility itself. I say I'll be skipping over that and just concentrating on the nuclear weapon and nuclear reactor aspects. Just to look at the two types of submarine, two classes of submarine that are refitted here, that visit here. There's the hunter-killer submarines, the Trafalgar class here, and soon to be the Astute class. They carry this sort of weaponry. They carry torpedoes, tigerfish torpedoes, harpoons, these are ship-to-ship missiles, and possibly they will carry Tomahawk cruise missiles, which in future are likely to be nuclear-capable. The American Tomahawks are nuclear capable. It's likely that these in the hunter-killer submarines, the Trafalgars and the Astutes, will be also nuclear capable. And of course you have the new class of submarine, the Vanguard, which carries a similar array of conventional weaponry. And these weapons themselves are enough to destroy one of these submarines, as you know from the Kursk, the Russian Federation submarine, which was downed by a number of torpedoes going off inadvertently in its main torpedo forward room. And of course, in addition, the Vanguard submarine carries Trident missiles and multiple warheads on that. So you have nuclear weapons. And of course, the Royal Navy will say, well, nuclear weapons will never be brought. We'll neither confirm nor deny the presence of nuclear weapons, but this is a refit dockyard. They'll never come in armed. Well, I can tell you, if there's a Vanguard class submarine that runs into trouble nearby, it's not going to make for Faz Lane and Coalport to disarm. It's going to run straight into Devonport. Because just 2 years ago, HMS Tarlis was in the Mediterranean. It ran into trouble, and it made straight into Gibraltar with a serious reactor, a problem on board. So there's no guarantee that these boats will not carry nuclear weapons. Now, the reactor compartment is stern of the sail on the, that's the conning tower, on the Trafalgar class, and on the larger Vanguard class, it's stern of the missile compartment. This red area, this red block, which is about 8 metres long, about 11 metres diameter for these boats, is in that area, weighs about 800 tonnes. Incidentally, you can tell where it is, because there's two red paint marks to show where the compartment is on the boats on the outside. And this is a reactor compartment in a Valiant-class submarine, now decommissioned, of course, but the red area here is the reactor crammed with machinery. To the stern of that is a turbo machine that raises the steam and generates the electricity that drives the systems. And forward of it is the accommodation and control compartments, and then far forward is the torpedo rooms. So the reactor compartment is an enclosed compartment which is not man-accessible while the reactor is operating. It's very intensely radioactive in here. This is a lead-shielded compartment. And to get from the front to the back of the boat, forward to the stern of the boat, you clamber through a tunnel. You can just see the tunnel at the top of the slide there. So the reactor compartment is an isolated compartment, and that forms one of the barriers or one of the containments of the reactor. On nuclear safety, there's another shot of the reactor. The top one is looking down. The red blob is the actual reactor pressure vessel, and all the pipework is the primary and secondary circuits. And this shear plan here shows the reactor with its neutron insulation around it. And the reactor pressure vessel itself is about this size. When you're looking at the hazards, what you have to determine is the fuel, the irradiated fuel, the nuclear fuel inside the reactor pressure vessel. And that's shown here schematically by this green blob. Incidentally, the part that went desperately wrong on Tarlis and was shown to be an inherent defect in all the other Trafalgar-class submarines and Swiftsures was that pipe that's running off that limb on the right-hand side. That's the pressurizer feed line. And on HMS Tarlis, this developed two longitudinal cracks creeping up the pipe. Pipe's about this diameter, and there were two cracks developing along up here. And of course, in engineering, when a material is brittle, as the crack gets to a certain length, it becomes critical. If you take a piece of this useless report, have a crack in a piece of metal. Well, that's okay, that hasn't got any cracks in it. Put a little crack in it like this, it's still quite strong. If you make the crack a bit longer, it's still quite strong. You get to a certain length, then it just tears. And that happens in steels. So on Tarlis, the cracks were getting very near their critical length. The problem here is, on this type of fault, although you can't see the valves, on each side of these spigots, there are big valves that are able to isolate the circuits. But this is inboard of the valves, and there's no way of isolating this. This would have led to a major loss of coolant accident. And that's what I want to talk about, the possibility of a major accident while the boat's in the dockyard. The hazard is the fuel. This is Navy fuel. This is a plate fuel because the Navy reactors are very small. They have to have maximum heat transfer. So the fuel, instead of comprising big, thick rods like a civil nuclear power station, are made up of these foils packs. And because there's so much heat to get out in such a small space, the fuel itself, the highly enriched uranium, is mixed with zirconium, another metal, in what's called a cermet, an integrated sintered material, and then wrapped in zircalloy, this zirconium clad. This material is very important when one looks at the safety of the malfunctioning performance of a reactor like this. So just remember how exotic this fuel is. Let's just try and compare this nuclear reactor, submarine reactor, with a civil reactor like Hinkley Point B in Somerset. Well, I won't go through the thing, but the top line says that the power output is about 30 megawatts, 30 million watts, compared to Hinkley Point B, about 600 megawatts. The amount of uranium fuel in Hinkley is 100 tons. In a submarine reactor, because it's so compact, it's a quarter of a ton, it's 220 kilograms. The enrichment, the amount of fissile material that's crammed into the fuel at Hinkley is only 2 to 3%. On a naval reactor, it's 97%. It's highly fissile material, it's weapons-grade material. This means that the reactor can run for years and years and years without being refueled. Now, the longer you leave the fuel in a reactor, the more radioactive the fuel becomes, the more irradiated it becomes, therefore it's more hazardous. So the fuel burn-up gives you the radiotoxicity of the fuel. How much is going to come out if it comes out? So if you go through the sums, you can see that a comparative size, each submarine reactor is about one-tenth the size of the reactor at Hinkley Point. So that tiny submarine, that small submarine, is about one-tenth of Hinkley Point. So if you've got 10 submarines in now, you've got a Hinkley Point power station sitting in your city. Another comparison is, compared to other mobile sources of radioactivity. Well, at Hinkley Point, they ship out the irradiated fuel up to Sellafield, and a flask full of Magnox fuel from Hinkley Point, the A station, about 2.5 tons of fuel inside one of those yellow flasks you can see here, that contains 35,000 terabecquerels. Forget the units, just 35,000 units of radioactivity. A PWR flask, such as at Sizewell B, different type of reactor, pressurized water reactor, but similar to a Navy reactor, that contains 3.25 tons of fuel. That's about 74,000 terabecquerels, units of radioactivity. A nuclear reactor on a submarine, after what's called the equivalent life history core, which means it's been running for 100 days, is about 4 million terabecquerels. 4 million. So there's considerably more radioactivity in one of those small pressure vessels inside a submarine than there is on the other mobile sources. So the comparison is, yes, there's a lot of radioactivity inside a submarine. So let's have a look what the MOD's requirement, what the operator, the MOD, has to provide the local authority with in order for it to comply with Regulation 9.4 of these REPA regulations. It says the operator, the MOD, shall provide the local authority such information as necessary for the purposes of preparing off-site emergency plans for all reasonably foreseeable emergencies. All reasonably foreseeable emergencies. So I argue that covers every reasonable type of accident, every reasonable type of equipment malfunction, and terrorist attack. Now, the argument goes that you have to know the type of event to be able to plan the mitigation or countermeasures to avert it? And that's the question we really must ask. So, are all reasonably foreseeable emergency worst-case incidents? Are they in a maximum design accidents? These are our nuclear engineers' talk and specify accidents. And do they include terrorist attacks? Right, now, before we talk about the accidents that the MOD nominate to occur at Devonport or within Devonport, let's have a look at the fundamental safety criteria for nuclear safety. When you talk about is containment, the first level of containment is trying to keep the radioactivity, the particles of radioactivity, in the fuel. And you saw from the first slide, that previous slide, how flimsy the fuel is. It runs at incredibly high temperatures, it expands and shrinks and contracts, it's incredibly heavily irradiated, and that's your first line of defence. The foil that goes around each blade is about half a millimetre to a millimetre thick. The second line of defence is the reactor primary vessel. I've just shown the reactor primary circuit. I've just shown the pressure vessel here, but there's a loop that comes off. So the red bit is that. And the third level of containment is the submarine hull itself, the reactor compartment. So you have three levels of containment between it and you. The fuel, the primary circuit, and the reactor compartment. Three levels of containment before this stuff gets out into the open.
Okay. Now the MOD, for DevPub's sake, they nominate three accidents. The first accident, C1,
is a local fuel leak inside the reactor pressure vessel. So the reactor fuel cladding fouls, and the fission products, those tiny particles of intense radioactivity, move into the primary circuit. But they're contained within the primary circuit. So that's now contained in the containment, so there's no risk to the public. The second accident that's nominated in DevPub Safe is a significant fuel leak. Again, the reactor breaks down, the fuel breaks down, but leaks into the primary circuit, then out of the primary circuit, into the reactor containment. Some of that radiation shines through the submarine hull. The third one is, again, the fuel breaks down, leaks past the secondary containment, the reactor vessel, into the primary, the reactor compartment, and there's a slow leak from the reactor compartment into the atmosphere. So these are the three nominated accidents that DevPub Safe is geared to counter. Let's just have a look at those. Well, the first one represents no hazard to members of the public, nor to people working along the dockside. As a matter of course, the submarine would be evacuated because the radiation has not got outside the primary reactor circuit. The second one, these slides really get good now, they start moving around and jumping around. The second one, oh, look at this. Look, this guy. The second one, C2, is where the radioactivity gets into the reactor compartment. It doesn't necessarily escape in any great quantity, but shines through the steelwork. Now, this one is also nominated by the MOD in a book of reference called BR3019 as a design case accident, which they consider. It's called BRO. Or BR0. Now this one, if you look at a plan of a submarine, where's the reactor compartment there, and if you had a Geiger counter, for this accident, you could then track these levels of radiation around the submarine. And I've done these in sievert units. These are doses of exposure against distance. So looking at the vertical scale, 30, 60, 90, 120 metres. The curved lines are the exposure rates from shine only. That's the sort of shine if you had an electric bar fire and switch it on, you get heat from it. There's nothing in the air, it's just the heat, the radiation shining. If you take a firefighter, a local authority firefighter, for that particular accident,
he and not she, because
women firefighters are not allowed to attend nuclear incidents, he could stand there for 1 hour
before he received his all-incident dose
for a year. So he could get within 60 metres of this submarine. Not too close, actually, to fight a fire or an incident. Okay, let's go on to the next scenario, which DebPubSafe says is the worst scenario. Well, this one is called BR3. This one, again, is a loss of coolant accident. The fuel breaks down, gets into the reactor compartment, and the fuel starts melting down. Melting. So much more radioactivity is released because the fuel tends to liquefy and vaporize. The whole compartment fills with steam, and again it shines through this. And this shows you the distances, again only radiation shine, that occur in the immediate aftermath of this incident. Within 10 meters of the submarine, 1,000 millisieverts an hour, 1 sievert an hour, that's roughly your, what's called the LD50 dose. You could, if you stood there for an hour, 50% of the people so exposed would die. Members of the public, to receive your member of the public dose, which is 1 millisievert per year, if you stood at 400 meters from this submarine, you would receive your equivalent yearly dose in 1 hour. Now, what's interesting about this one is this. That all these doses are within the dockyard perimeter. Because the dockyard has a perimeter of 550 metres, so everything's okay. So, there's the dockyard. Could be Timbuktu, for all I know. There's the nuclear site licence, the nuclear site boundaries. And this sort of ugly green one is the sort of automatic evacuation, automatic countermeasure zone, the 550 countermeasure zone. Now, those three accidents, their immediate effects are all within this boundary. So, in other words, the MOD has to take no off-site action because it's all controlled within on-site. So, the C1 to C3 scenarios, nominated and identified in DebPubSafe, are mainly radiation shine, all quite leisurely, and mostly within the dockyard boundary. So our Boy Scout here can say, you know, stay indoors, pop an iodine tablet, and you're okay. Well, that's not so, because if you look at the BR3019 documents, you'll see another accident called BR6 nominated in there. And this is an accident, a design case accident, the MOD take seriously, themselves plan for, but do not release into the public sector, apparently. Now, the question you ask, has the MOD tailored the C1, C2, C3 accidents to suit the dockyard boundaries? In other words, is there any relationship between a real accident and 550 metres? Was there a relationship when those people in the 17th or 16th century were designing the dockyard? They said, oh, hang on a minute, you've got to make it 550 metres. These nuclear submarines are coming in 300 years. And they said, someone said, well, we haven't beat Napoleon yet. What's these metres you're talking about? So let's have a look at the BR6. Now, this is where the graphics really get good. BR6. Then fuel breaks down. Fuel migrates from the fuel rods or fuel plates into the primary circuit. That's the red bit. The primary circuit breaks down very abruptly. The fuel melts. There's a couple of bits of chemistry going on. There's two massive explosions, and it rips through the submarine hull. And this is an immediate release scenario, possibly releasing all of those 4 million terabecquerels, those 4 million units of radioactivity. Let's have a look at the mechanics of this. This is what happens in a reactor compartment. Look, don't worry about this graph too much. The vertical represents the pressure. Going along is the time. There's some markers here. About a minute into the incident, you can see there's a big pressure pulse called a steam blowdown. 3 minutes in, there's a core melt. In 3 minutes, the core melts. In 10 to 20 minutes, there's a hydrogen burn because the zirconium fuel cladding and fuel reacts with the steam and produces hydrogen. And then there's a final failure of 3 hours. Now within 3 to 20 minutes, you can have a major explosion, a major risk of release. This looks a bit simpler on one of these. This is how it goes. Loss of coolant, the pipes break, you can't get in emergency coolant water. The fuel melts down in 3 minutes. Remember, you've got 30 megawatts of power, which on a water reactor means 90 million watts of energy being pumped into something weighing a quarter of a ton. It just melts. Too much heat going in.
So within 3 minutes, the fuel starts melting down.
Within 10 to 20 minutes, the temperatures are such that it's sufficient now to have a zirconium steam reaction. This is an exothermic, a heat-generating reaction that strips, it's oxygen-hungry, so it strips the oxygen out of the steam and leaves hydrogen. The hydrogen cooks, and then you can have a hydrogen explosion. And this explosion is reckoned to put the whole containment at risk within 20 minutes. So let's forget the 24 hours, the slow leaks that the MOD say can happen in C2 and C3. This one is a bang and it's out. And finally, the last one is the fuel burns its way through the bottom of the pressure vessel, that steel pressure vessel, and drops into what's called the shield tank. This is a tank of cold water that the reactor sits in to cut down the radiation for the crew. And you get molten fuel, a quarter of a ton of molten fuel, dropping into relatively cold water. Now you can imagine the amount of energy that that generates, and this would certainly put the whole containment at risk. It would challenge the pressure that the submarine is designed to resist. And that can occur up to 3 hours. So this type of BR6 accident is the one I suggest should be included in the plan. I know this is small print, but it makes a comparison. We've forgotten the first C1 accident because that's nothing. Look at the time. The last two that are in dead pub safe, C2 and C3, 24 hours seepage. That's 24 hours before the physical radioactivity gets out the submarine compartment.
And look how much radioactivity is released. Between 4 to 40 terabecquerels.
4 to 40 units of radiation. Talk about iodine in a minute, but look at the tiny amount of iodine there. 0.04 to 0.4 terabecquerels. Come down. Up goes the release on the second one. Still a very slow 24-hour seepage. Lots of time to polish the fire engines, get the Wellington boots on, grease up the stirrup pumps, get it all going. But look at BR6. 40,000...
4 million units of radioactivity all out.
In less than 1 hour, up to 3 hours. It's the rapidity of this accident that's the difficult thing to mitigate against. Here it is again. Go through the scale from C2, BR0, C3, BR3, BR6. Increasing energy of the event. Much more energy. And when you talk about radioactivity, radioactive releases, you've got to get the stuff up in the air. The more energy they have, the bigger the plume. The bigger the plume, the higher the plume, the more lofting, the more dispersion, the greater the area under threat. So, we want to look for a relationship between the energy of C2 and C3. Oh, look at this. 1% leakage, 10% to atmosphere over 24 hours. But look at this BR6, all out in 10 minutes with a lot of energy to get it up, get it across. We're not talking about 550 metres here. We might be talking about 10 kilometres for evacuation. Okay. This is what the present dead pub safe does. I don't know what the new dead pub safe, because it hasn't been published yet, will be. But this is the present dead pub safe. There's your dockyard, with your little triangle there. The 550-metre automatic countermeasure zone, the dockyard, effectively. And the 2-kilometre pre-planned countermeasure zone, circled around it. That's what dead pub safe says. And it says, oh, but we can extend it. We can extend it out to 10 kilometres. If things get really bad, we'll extend it out to 10 kilometres. But, you know, the problem is the resources you need to extend emergency plan are not linear to the distance. They're square of the distance, because they deal with areas rather than linear distances. So let's try and match those three accidents I've nominated to these. Well, first of all, I've got to tell you about ERLs, emergency reference levels. Look, I'll get on the platform for this.
What you do is you have
two levels. You have a lower level and a higher level.
ERLs are the emergency reference levels of exposure.
Radiation exposure. So, whole body is a radiation over my whole body, from shine mostly. Cloud of radiation going overhead, radiation on the ground, shining up, rather like that electric bar fire. You have a lower level for sheltering, say 3 millisieverts. The argument goes like this: you don't do anything until you get to 3 millisieverts, because if you went at 3 millisieverts, you'd probably be wasting resources. If you started your countermeasures before 3 millisieverts, you might be wasting valuable resources, put them in the wrong place, or whatever. So you don't start any countermeasures until you're going above this. But you must have your countermeasures in place to avert any member of the public getting a dose of over 30 millisieverts. So in other words, the emergency planners will instruct people to shelter when they believe the dose is running at 3 millisieverts in the incident, and they will certainly have had to have them sheltering in order to avert this upper limit of 30 millisieverts. For evacuation, you don't start evacuation until 30 millisieverts, the lower limit, but you must have them evacuated by 300 millisieverts. Remember, the present level is 1 millisievert per year. Is the present normal level of radiation, setting aside medical radiation. Then there's the other one, there's the organ dose. Now this is the organ dose. I've chosen one here called the iodine dose, the thyroid dose. This means the amount of radioactivity you take into your body, which stays in your body. And some of our organs have a peculiar habit of reconcentrating radioactivity. So, for example, radioactive iodine, the thyroid, sweeps the body of iodine. It can't tell, it's not very intelligent, it can't tell whether it's stable iodine, or which you get in seaweed, or whether it's unstable radioactive iodine. So what it does is it sweeps the body, concentrates it in the thyroid, and young children, neonates, etc., very active thyroids, run the risk of cancer, thyroid cancer. This is what happened after Chernobyl. Real trigger of levels. The present levels are 30 millisieverts. That's your lower level. Don't do anything until 30. And you've got to have it in by 300. Well, the World Health Organization has recently recommended that that lower level come down to 10. And the NRPB, the National Radiological Protection Board, it's now recommending strongly that the upper limit be brought down to 100 because of recent research. And you people are worried about tritium. Christ. This is the stuff you should worry about. So let's have a look at those limits and accidents. First, the whole body and sheltering and evacuation, all that way around, and then the iodines. Just to explain those limits again, if you take a family, for example, if you look at the whole body dose, there are the limits shown on a graph. The vertical scale is the radiation dose, how much dose I receive, how many sieverts I receive, sort of thing you measure on a film bag. The horizontal scale I'm going to use as a distance scale later on. But you can express the ERLs, the higher and lower and sheltering limits, as bands running across the graph. So I mustn't exceed the top one, mustn't do anything before I go into the bottom one. That's the whole body dose. And here's another lovely moving graphic. That affects everyone. Everyone gets whole body dose. So all age groups, all critical groups have to be looked at in terms of whole body dose. You have to treat iodine uptake in a different way. Let's put the iodine levels in. These are marvellous slides, aren't they? Look at this. I mean, this is wonderful. This is really grim, this one. Look, it sort of glows. You have to treat the ERLs in a different way here, because there are particular groups that are critical to uptake. Children's thyroids are extremely active and can sweep very quickly. So there's arguments here that you should have separate dose limits for different critical groups, age-related dose limits. Particularly critical are young babies, neonates, and nursing mothers because of the milk cycling route. The dad there is not really worried, you know, he's slumbering away. So we've got these limits expressed like this. Of course, if I now put the new limits, the recommended limits, you'll see these limits now compress down the ERLs. They come very close together. I'm using a logarithmic scale here, by the way. Anyway, let's have a look at our accidents now. Well, these are my projections for the strength of the whole body dose for these three accidents over distance in kilometres. So take, you can see the C2 one is a lesser accident over 24 hours. It would have that effect in terms of dose. It would decrease quite rapidly over the distance. Remember this scale here, that 10 to the 1 is 10, 10 to the 3 is 1,000, 10 to the 5 is 100,000. A scaled, compressed scaled, log scale. Look at BR6 up there. See how much higher it is? It's at 100,000 compared to just over 10, or about 100, 200 for the BR2, the BR3 one, the C3, which they reckon is the worst case. Let's put the ERLs on that and see what it means in terms of those evacuation and sheltering. This is the evacuation one. Now you can see, and believe me, this is quite simple, the way it's presumably presented, because working out radioactive distribution in urban townscapes is very, very difficult, particularly when you've got sea breezes to take into account. So these are broad brush figures. You can see here, hey, this is pretty good. Look, the C2, no evacuation is necessary. The worst accident should be C3. The worst accident that the MOD nominate for Devonport, you don't have to evacuate anyone. Fine, because it's under the lower ERL here. But look at BR6. You'd certainly have to evacuate people out to 9.5 kilometres, possibly out to about 30 kilometres in between the lower and upper ERL limits. So, just to give you an idea, if it was all nice and you were in a nice open field, there wasn't any buildings or these terrible building developments I see here, your town centre, then it would be a nice clean sweep. You'd expect the plume to follow a southwesterly direction, developing like a tear shape, and decreasing in strength the further it got away as it spread out and diluted. So in reality, if I now put that against Plymouth, here's our 9 kilometre, 10 kilometre circle, we would, under the BR6, have to evacuate out to 9 to 10 kilometres. Now that's a great deal farther than 2 kilometres. This is beginning to press against the limit of extendability acknowledged for the Dead Pub Safe scheme. So our evacuation would take us out to 10 kilometres on a good day. Let's have a look at sheltering. Well, for sheltering, remember sheltering starts when you go just above the lower ERL, or the upper ERL for sheltering. You see you'd have to sheltering, you only have to shelter for the worst C3 accident nominate. Only, hey, that's convenient, 2 kilometres. That fits exactly the pre-planned countermeasure zone. Wow, I wonder how that occurred. But the BR6 takes you out to 20 kilometres. 20 kilometres. And probably further, because you'd have to start these sheltering measures before. Now look at the iodine. This is the one you want to worry about. Oh, there's the zones. The map's getting a bit sort of bigger here. Just before we get on to the iodine, let's have a look how that dose is received by people a kilometre away from the incident centre. Outside the dockyard, 500 metres outside the dockyard. Well, 4% of it would come from ground shine, or shine of radioactivity stuck to building road surfaces. 4%, not much. About 30% of that would come from cloud shine. That's radiation beaming down from the cloud of contaminated material passing over your heads. 34%. The majority of the dose comes from inhalation. That's taking the radiation particles into your body and being retained in your body and acting continuously like little batteries. Now the problem here is that sheltering is pretty effective against ground shine because you're indoors. And it's pretty effective against cloud shine because you've got a roof between you and it and some bricks. But it's not that effective against inhalation. So even sheltering is doubtful against the major contributing factor of radiation dose in these types of accident. Now iodine. The basic countermeasure for iodine is to issue... You've stolen me water. No, it's okay. ..is to issue tablets which soak up the thyroid with iodine, stable iodine, iodate. So any radioactive iodine circulates. Obviously, you have to distribute these tablets ahead of the arrival of the radioactive cloud. And the main obvious route is respiration. Okay. Now, for the worst case accident nominated by the MOD, iodine prolaxis, that's issuing the tablets, has to occur for about 1 kilometre. If I put in BR6, this is a nice slide, dynamics, nice. You can see for BR6, the iodine release requires these prolactic measures to be started up to 30 kilometres from the centre of the site. If I now introduce the new recommended ERLs, the World Health Organization, you know, not some sort of greenie group, and our own NRPB, this does this. It compresses down that limit, upper ER and lower ER, and of course it moves the C3 accident to 3 kilometres and the BR6 accident up to about 110 kilometres. So now our area is getting very large indeed for countermeasures. And remember, what you're interested with iodine is suppressing youngsters, suppressing the thyroid of kids. So schools, children at play, breastfeeding mothers have to be tackled immediately and individually. So for the BR6 PITS consumption, these PITS are the potassium iodate tablets, that's the sort of area under the present regulations. I then, those little blue yellow circles are, I don't know where your potassium iodate tablet distribution centres are, but they're usually close in on the town. They're certainly not out on Dartmoor. Don't know what you do about the prisoners, by the way. So that's, if we adopt the NRPB and WHO standards, these are the revised tablets. Take your tablets if you're out at sea. So that's the impact of a serious, realistic accident or incident at Devonport. I just want to briefly talk about nuclear weapons on the premise that these boats are capable of carrying nuclear weapons. What we're interested in, I'll just go back and I should never show you anything like this. All top secret. This is a nuclear weapon. The top bit's the thermo device, the hydrogen device. The little ball in the middle is a fission device. That's really interesting, a fission device. And so we're interested in this football size thing. It's about this size. The whole weapon's about the size of a long waste paper bin. This football size thing contains the plutonium inside. We can do this now. We'll have a look inside. Close your eyes if you're a loyal citizen. The assembly is made up like this. It's a wonderful slide, this. The plutonium, hollow plutonium sphere is inside, is wrapped in a series of tampers, but importantly, high explosives. This is the plutonium sphere here. It's got some bits and pieces inside. These are high explosive charges that serve to compress, these are shape charges, coalesce and compress on this sphere to force it down to about the size of a pea, at which it goes supercritical and creates a fissile nuclear detonation. Well, the risk here is not of a nuclear detonation. There is a risk, but not a very significant one, is a fire inside a missile silo, the explosives going off or frazzling, burning, and then the plutonium, because it's a pure metal, will actually burn itself. And if you're burning plutonium, producing plutonium oxide, a very finely divided oxide, and that means a tiny speck size, which is enough to actually enter the respiratory system and then be reconcentrated on the skeletal frame in your liver and in your gonads. And of course, that represents a very significant intake indeed. And all the ERL systems just don't work for it. You have to offer immediate respiratory protection, a mask, to all the people in the area. Now the Americans, this is the next wonderful slide, showing the release of plutonium. And this comes out the cloud and you breathe it in. The old American standard, the maximum tolerable body burden of plutonium-239, is highly fissile material used in nuclear weapons, was 1/10 of 1/1,000,000 of 1 gram. So that's how much an individual was considered to tolerate before there was a significant health impact. 1/10 of 1/1,000,000 of 1 gram. A typical weapon contains about 5 to 8 kilograms of plutonium. Obviously not all of those 1/10, 1/1,000,000, 1/10 of a gram will actually disperse like that, but nevertheless, you can see just one weapon burning, aerosolizing, distributing in the atmosphere and coming down on a city this size could have a very significant health impact in the interim and longer terms. The Americans, faced with this accident, their standard manuals for accidents involving nuclear weapons would be rather like this. Immediate evacuation for about 2, 3, 4 kilometres, depending on the site commander's information. Respiratory protection, masks, high filter masks, keepers, and sheltering, and then sheltering possibly out as far as 40 to 50 kilometres. So that's, in short, the consequences of a nuclear weapon accident occurring in a dockyard, irrespective of whether the Ministry of Defence confirm or deny. Incidentally, all this data comes from British tests carried out in Maralinga in Australia in the late 50s, early 60s, called the Vixen test, where they deliberately burnt nuclear weapons, subjected to accidents like lorry fires, aircraft crashes, to see what the effect was. And at Maralinga, they found that the respiratory safeguards, where you needed protection from uptake, respiratory uptake, varied between 17 to 34 miles. And that was in the 50s, 60s, when the limits were somewhat different. So, one more thing, this is a lovely slide, it's a bit macabre. It's got some sounds on this one. Oh, you can't hear them now. One more thing, it's terrorist attack. Terrorism. And what I'm going to say about this, I wrote to the MOD and asked them whether the report of assessment, that's the one they send to the health and safety executive, contains DBTs, design basis threats. Do they take account of terrorist attacks? Because the city of Plymouth, I put to you, would have to understand the nature of the accident, the incident, or the event to be able to counter it. So do they take account of terrorism? These are the answers I got. Well, the Ministry of Defence said, this was their reply, which I'm going to just briefly put down here, was, the report of assessment is confidential. Ah. And there's no need to specifically plan for terrorist attack. And anyway, the countermeasure zone, the pre-planning, is extendable to cover terrorist attack.
Wow.
So, not deterred, I whipped off a quick letter to the Home Office to operate this very odd committee called the Chemical, Biological, Radiological and Nuclear Committee, whose membership is secret. And they said to me, well, the DBTs, the design-based threats, are confidential, we can't tell you those. So I said, well, who do you tell? Well, we can't tell you that. And the CBRN, well, that's secret as well. So I thought, well, not giving up. I said to one of my dogs, Jack Russell, well, what would you do? He said, oh, I'm a terrier, I'd go for it. Really go for it now. So I wrote to the DTI, their nuclear security unit. And they said, you've already received these answers from the MOD and the Home Office, go away. We're not going to answer. The problem is no one is prepared to discuss terrorist attacks in this country. course, Devonport Dockyard is the naval base of the Trafalgar-class submarines that were used in the Afghanistan
attacks. They were one of the first submarines to fire cruise missiles into Afghanistan. So clearly, people in Afghanistan will be somewhat peeved and would certainly look towards Devonport as being a target. So, what I take you is this. You should ask the MOD some questions. The questions are, do they provide sufficient information on the hazards? That's, have they told Plymouth City Council how much radiation, how much radioactivity, what type of radioactivity is inside their submarines? Have they told the council what type of nuclear weapons they could be carrying if a Vanguard class submarine was to have to scoot into here under emergency repairs, rather like TARDIS scooting into Gibraltar?
Have they provided, or will they provide, on the types of accident and incident? Will they actually provide the council with that sort of information? Because I put to you that the council needs to know that if it's going to effectively plan. Will they tell the council of the severity of those accidents and incidents? And I say to you, according to the present DebPubSafe, no. Because they've never included any accidents above BR3C3. Where I say they should include BR6. And will they give sufficient information, this is absolutely critically important, on the rate of radioactive release, how quickly the release comes out of the reactor? And DebPubSafe just doesn't mention it. Now that's very important. If you've got 24 hours to prepare, as I said, grease up your stirrup pumps, polish your Wellington boots, that's very much more better than having to do it within 20 minutes. So, do they answer these questions? The present DebPubSafe does not. It omits the conventional nuclear weapons components. It omits the reactor BR6 blowout and nuclear weapons accidents. It assumes all accidents are relatively leisurely events, developing over hours and not minutes, as for BR6. And it takes no account of terrorism, no account of multiple incidents where you've got a series of related incidents occurring. Not just one World Trade Center, two World Trade Centers. Pentagon being attacked. The fourth aircraft going to Three Mile Island, possibly. So that's what you call a multiple attack that throws the system of defense into disarray. No, it doesn't include those. Should it? I would say yes. So on that first question I asked you, has the MOD tailored those DebPubSafe accidents, C1, C2, C3, to fit the dockyard space available? Well, why don't you ask them? Just ask them. How do you relate these accidents to the 550-metre zone and the 2-kilometre pre-planned countermeasure zone? What's the relationship between the accidents? Is there some physical law that says that fits that? Or is it being contrived? Ask them about that. Well, Plymouth, when Plymouth published their new DebPubSafe, when? You must ask them, does it extend to cover the BR6 event? That's evacuation out to 12 kilometres, sheltering to 30, potassium iodate tablet, prolactis, out to 100 kilometres or more. Can it deal with a rapid radioactive release in less than an hour? Because, you know, DebPubSafe has got this amazing military hierarchical structure which your local council, you know, DebPubSafe assumes that the public will respond by all standing to attention and turning to the right when they're told. People don't act like that when they're under stress. How will the City of Plymouth put in place a rigid plan like this? Will it cope with a nuclear weapons event? They have no information on nuclear weapons, so how can it cope with a nuclear weapons event? Similarly, terrorist attack. And importantly this, will Plymouth remain dependent on the Ministry of Defence for off-site monitoring, or will it have its own monitoring systems? Will it train its staff in the means of how to monitor radiation, how to differentiate between the types of radiation, the types of chemistry that are active,
the environmental conditions of the accident underway? Or will it simply say to the MOD,
what do we do, Governor? If it says that, does it know how the MOD arrives at its decision and its judgment about countermeasures? Does the MOD take account of the fact, instead of having a couple of hundred squaddies, you're going to have a couple of hundred thousand people to deal with, members of the public to deal with? So they need to know how the MOD goes about its judgments. And can it identify and segregate the critical groups, particularly children, in this type of accident scenario I've described? Those are the questions you must ask the Plymouth City Council. And they say, as yet, we don't know what their answers are because they've yet to publish their scheme. And finally, I thought I'd leave you with a slide that took me hours to master. It's this one. And we say goodbye as he goes down. And, here we go. Plop. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, John.
Should it be an accident or an emergency situation? What, in your opinion, John, would be the time scale before they actually came and told the members of the public? Because we have regular meetings with DML, and when this question was put to them, they tell us that, well, we do have minor releases of radioactivity, but we have to have a committee meeting to decide the severity of the accident and whether people should be told. So what, in your opinion, John, would be the timescale between the accident and people in the vicinity finding out about it?
The position of an emergency plan, first of all, the dockyard is surrounded by this monitoring system, and they'd be pretty aware of what was going on with the onboard equipment. So the problem with an emergency plan is trying to relate, to extrapolate, look forward, to see how the radioactive release is developing and how it will disperse, where it will disperse to. The problem is, you've got about 90-odd different radionuclides, strontium, cobalt, etc., thorium, like, you know, you've got 90, and each one has a different chemistry. Each one has a different radiotoxicity. And each one has a different type, could have a different type of radiation. So what you have to do is, those graphs that I was doing were simply a sort of compendium. You literally have to work out the ERL for each of those 90 individual radionuclides. You can do it in groups. You do this, you can do it by computer programs now, but it takes quite a long time and a lot of experience to try and project ahead where the cloud, the strength of the cloud, will be in a 2 hours' time and where it will come down. And there's another difficulty. When you talk about a landscape, all the Pascal stability criteria, this is the techno tool for dispersion, is all based on a nice plain field. When you get to a town, the complexity of Plymouth, an urban townscape, give you an example. After Chernobyl, the town, workers' town of Chernobyl, was Pripyat, about 6 kilometres to the east. And I was out there 2 weeks doing some, 2 weeks after that, doing some monitoring. And we were in a helicopter, a Western Gamma spectrometer. And we had to tell Ivan, the driver of this helicopter, best way to describe it as a driver, to move from street to street as we were scanning about 60, 70 metres apart. And every other street, every third or fourth street, suddenly the meters would go completely off scale. And one of the problems is actually townscapes are very, very difficult to work out dispersion patterns. You've all seen your wonderful architects there where they, you know, the piece of paper goes round, the debris goes round in the middle of a building courtyard. And it means that the interference of buildings makes it very difficult to predict the dispersion. So the first dilemma for an emergency planner is to work out the strength of the radioactive release, say an hour's time, and then to work out where it will come down. Then he's got the problem of saying to people, well, if I evacuate, if I leave them in shelter, If I tell them to shelter and I'm wrong, I've then got to tell them to evacuate. And that's difficult because you've got to convince them to get out. If you leave it too late, you've got to evacuate them to a safe area, but you've got to bring them out into the open, and you may have to move them through contaminated areas. And you may not have the resource to map out the extent of the contamination. So it's an incredibly difficult thing to do in an urban town state. So I would say to you, how quick? Well, who knows? Who knows?
Sorry to come back to you right away, but
I can see the submarines from my bedroom window.
Speak up, please.
I can see the submarine from my bedroom window, so obviously we're fairly close. What really concerns me, and it's not just for me, it's for the family, it's for my daughters, if there's going to be this committee, these group of people that sit down and decide upon the risk, isn't it going to be rather too late for the people like me who live within 500 yards of the
dockyard? If it's not a well-ordered procedure, if it's not an automatic type of procedure that's able to take in a mass of information, digest and interpret the information, and then take immediate action, then emergency plans are not worth the paper they're written. It's as simple as that. But now, whether Plymouth can actually put in place this incredible sort of militaristic hierarchical system called DEDCOP, say. See, one of the things that the Ministry of Defence may look at under these new REPA regulations is that because the local authority take over total responsibility for off-site planning, it frees up MOD resources to actually deal with the accident or the incident on site. So you may see a lessening of capacity, resource, to deal with off-site measures. But the fundamental problem, as I see it, with the present DEDCOP safe plan is that as soon as these things are relatively leisurely events over which there will be time to react. And my experience of reactor accidents is they can be very, very rapid indeed.
Okay, thanks for that.
Yes, Ian, I'm sorry, but I might come back to you later. There's two at the back there. Firstly, woman there in the middle. Would you like to use the microphone so everyone can hear, please? Thank you.
I'm very concerned, Tony, about this idea that there are no councillors here tonight and no MPs. Now, the people of Plymouth, I'm not Plymouth Side, I'm Saul Townsbury, and I should be writing to Colin Breed about it. But the MPs and the councillors here are elected to represent and to help the people of the city and protect them. Now, if they don't come to anything like this, how can they know what's going on? Does it mean that they want to shut their ears and their eyes? Because, of course, the ultimate thing about this is that the submarine should never have come here. And for those of us who have campaigned for many years against nuclear things, I find it appalling that it's been stuck in the centre of a big carnation. And I really think that with the elections coming up, it's up to the people here to get hold of their councillors and their MPs, Linda Gilroy, and who's the other chap? Yes, they have gone from me, so it was a little, I think. Jameson. Now, I can write to them as well, and I shall, because we are in the area where this thing could happen. But as to going to the MOD, I think it's up to the councillors, because the people here won't get any replies. I've written straight up to the minister, to Margaret Beckett, and I've had a very easy answer. I understand they're going to put another committee in place. Yes, I know my time's up, Tony. But that's going to be brought back in 2003, and perhaps I could leave you that letter afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The only thing I'll say is at least Saltash has got iodine tablets. I live in that plume area and I've never seen an iodine tablet in my life. Maybe I need to go to West Cornwall. Gentlemen, two along, please, Patrick.
My name's Ken Tucker. I know Mr. Large, we've had contact before. Basically, what I want to say, I think you have a slight advantage over all of us this evening, because you were, of course, one time the nuclear advisor of the City Council. So, in fact, at that time, you were inside looking out. Now you're outside looking in. And that gives you a different perspective, quite clearly. What I want to know is you've obviously taken an in-depth look at the DEDPUB safety plan, and it is in the area now being rejigged around, but that is no shadow of doubt. And for your information, the City Council did meet all the schools in February of this year, which are within the existing 2 km zone. If you could put your finger on one area which gave you the greatest concern, and you clearly are not happy with any of that the existing plan, and most probably you won't be with the new plan. If you could put your finger on one area which is the greatest weakness, what would that be?
It really would be the rapidity of a release. The fact that my very serious accident, incidentally I should say that BR6 is referenced in a number of MOD documents, classified documents, as being the design case, so it's not a figment of my imagination. The most difficult scenario to deal with would be a rapid release scenario, not necessarily the same magnitude as BR6, but very rapid release scenarios, and that means if you can break through the containment, then you would have a very rapid release, and of course a terrorist attack would break through the containment as well as an internal event. So it's the rapidity of release that's very difficult to deal with.
Can I just say, you know that within the plan there are four strands. There's the MOD, there's the health authority, there's the police, and the city council. Really, these strands will basically gel together. That we're not only talking about the MOD, and we're not only talking about Plymouth City Council, we're talking the wealth of organisations and all the backup which will be brought into the city. And I think basically what the schools have been campaigning for many, many years on is safety. We believe that we've achieved some degree of safety. Others may not agree with that, but in fairness, I believe that it mustn't be all doom and gloom.
No, but you mustn't see an entire effective countermeasure centred around potassium iodate tablets. They only protect, they only provide a degree of protection against iodine uptake. And iodine is only present in the release of a operational reactor, a recently operational reactor. So iodine is one of the elements you can countermeasure against effectively if you can get it in place for time. And of course you need to identify the critical groups. But if you talk about a weapons accident, or you talk about a refuel accident, where there's no criticality involved, then you're concerned with the other intensely radioactive materials that are also available. So simply issuing iodine tablets is no cure for the major problem of explosion.
Thank you. There's someone there, Patrick. Yes.
Thanks. You were talking about the VECO and DevPub Safe documents. And there seems to be one major area that hasn't been considered. I don't know if you left it out. And this is the fact that they're going to be chopping the reactors open and taking the fuel out and running it around the dockyard. What sort of scenario is likely to happen if someone drops one of these fuel plates or, you know, when the things are outside the reactor?
The what's happened since with the arrival of Vanguard, what happened was that Devonport, you all know this, Devonport was privatised, so it came under the Nuclear Installations Inspectorate and the Nuclear Installations Act. And the Nuclear Installations Inspectorate, to my belief, were very unhappy about this refit refuelling component of transferring the fuel when they picked it up with a giant crane and everyone left the dockyard and off it went. The types of accidents that you can involve during a refuel program are different to the ones I've been describing this evening. There's no iodine present because the fuel has been dead for some time. There's not much risk of a meltdown, so there's no catastrophic problems of the fuel melting through the pot, the reactor vessel, into the shield tank. There are problems with zirconium reactions. And of course, while you're refueling, although you've got these very fancy refueling rigs and houses that come over and lock onto the submarine, you've effectively got your containment open. So there's a lack of full containment. So there are a number of scenarios, but I say, what you would expect is you would expect the report of assessment that the operators submit to the HSC to identify all these hazards. And as yet, those documents are not publicly available. And I'm not sure that they will be made publicly available. And that's quite disturbing that the MOD, for example, are not prepared to release a completely open document. They've hinted that they will release the report of assessment once it's had any confidential data removed. I'll give you an example of how other countries deal with reactor accidents. If you take the good old Soviet Union, the Russian Federation, up in Severomorsk, which is up on the Kola in the Arctic, to deal with a submarine reactor accident there, they anticipate evacuating something like 200,000 people.
Thank you, John. That's a bit of a pause for thought there. The speaker here.
Hi, I'm Sandra Johnson. I live in Plymouth. I'm the chair of the Socialist Alliance. John, you mentioned that several times about the figures that DML and the MOD are using and how convenient it is that they all match the boundaries of the dockyard.
Yes.
Bearing in mind the fact that DML is a privately owned company, it's owned by a huge American multinational, and the accounting scandals that there have been recently, are we looking at damage limitation here to cover up their share price, perhaps? Does the profit motive have any bearing on the safety issue?
No, I mean, as much as I'd like to agree with you on this. The situation, there's a historical dimension. The way in which the nuclear industry was established in this country was that the Nuclear Installations Act, that's the primary safety act, requires that no person outside the site boundary should suffer injury by reason of the malfunction of the plant. So in other words, if you stood the most critical person, which is a baby, on the site fence, that wonderful chicken wire they use would stop all radiation. Now what that forced the companies to do, the operators to do, was use a technique called probabilistic risk analysis, where they would work out the probability of the Titanic being hit by an iceberg. And they said, if the probability, if the risk is acceptable, in other words, there's such a remote chance of an accident happening, then the consequences can be very bad because the accident will never happen. If the risk is unacceptable, a more frequent accident, then the consequences have to be tolerable. So you've got this composite between acceptable risk and tolerability of the consequences. Now what's happened with REPA is it's turned this old composite upside down, because the local authorities, they're not going to say, well, we accept that, there can be no accident of any severity that would affect us in the public. Because the first thing a member of the public should do, and I suggest someone should do this here, is take the local authority into a judicial review or something like that and say, we don't think your plan is acceptable or providing us with adequate protection. Please demonstrate to us it is. And I say the local council, be it Plymouth or Derby or Sellafield or wherever, is caught between a rock and a hard place, because obviously it doesn't have that much resource, it doesn't have that much training facility to actually prepare for a major accident. So it may be that it will accept the lesser severe accidents. To give you an idea of the cost of this, the DTI have said to these local authorities, the cost of providing an off-site plan should not involve costs of more than £10,000 for the entire off-site plan. Now, part of the council's responsibility is to agree with its employees who are going to be involved in the emergency measures their emergency radiation dose rates. So the council has to say to all its people who are going to be involved, from firefighters to street cleaners, and I mean the sweepers because they'll be involved, what radiation dose rate will you agree? This is what we're suggesting. Now, if they're going to impose radiation dose rates on people, they're going to have to actually buy dosimeters. So if you talk about here a couple of hundred people being involved in immediate emergency planning, the dosimeters for each one will probably cost you about 150 quid a time. So there's your 10,000 quid gone straight away. The cost of emergency planning, holding in contingency, is exceptionally expensive.
So it is about money. Can I just reassure you, there are a number of people who I have seen, I've got your hands, I'm going round your suite, I've got four outstanding, five now, and I will get to you all, don't worry about it. The next speaker I'm going to introduce, because Jill Wood is one of the Trident Ploughshares Seven, who actually staged the protests on the 3rd of February this year and are up at the Magistrates Court on the 12th of August. And I hope we're going to see a sizeable number of people here outside the Magistrates Court wishing them good luck in actually challenging the legality of Trident. Jill.
John, I would particularly like to thank you for your courage in coming here tonight. As you have just heard, I'm going to court. I've already been arrested for appearances in court. Now I'm going for trial. I've been in a cell. And at our skeleton trial, I particularly asked for you to appear as an expert witness, together with five other intelligent people who could speak for the people of Plymouth and be heard and listened to. And I was forbidden, and we were forbidden, to call any expert witnesses, not one. At the moment, our politicians and our councillors are playing ostrich. If they keep their head in the sands, we will go away. And with a little bit of help from nuclear energy, it might be a bit faster than they could think of. What I particularly am concerned of is the damage to the unborn children. This is my concern. I'm concerned of... I was part of the Isolus report. I'm concerned about up to 27 nuclear submarines, the past, present and future fleet, being dumped here in our beautiful city. And I'm getting no answers. And I would ask DML, is it not their mantra that they should do no harm and not suffer little children?
Thank you. There's a gentleman here. Put your hand up about 10 minutes ago. Put it over, huh? Okay, well, thank you. Thanks. This please.
I am a Conservative and I'm proud of it more than ever tonight. Perhaps I'm the only one in here, I don't know. Having said that, I'd like to say to you, you put up a wonderful, what I call, chemical analysis and things. I've worked on submarines all my life. I've helped design them. And I've written a lot of newsletters in this city, how I feel. And there's one thing I believe in. This is it. There's a song called Rule Britannia, Britain rules the waves, and Britain never, never shall be slaves. Now then, you've got a Blair who's the biggest idiot in this country. He's all right when he's working with the Americans, but he's been no good for this country at all. He's let the Labour Party down completely. That's why I should say 7/8 of the people in this country are going to vote Labour and Conservative next. And I'm sure of that because they will not ever come back to Labour again. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to get an article in the Sun newspaper before long. And I've helped this city for over... I've helped this city for over 30 years and I've spent more like something like 10 or 12,000 even in the last 2 years to help the city get by. And I certainly will never, never vote for Labour because I think they're letting the country down everywhere. And I'd like to hear somebody praise that.
Not all right.
Come on, Mary, if I'm the only one, I've got the guts to say it.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thank you for having the guts. I really don't mind party political broadcasts. Everybody should say what they feel.
We're all your Labour people.
That's fine.
The legs stuck in the sand.
I haven't got any Labour people. I'm a different party. Anyway, let's carry on. There's a gentleman right at the back who's been enormously patient there. Thank you also. You did a load of hands sprung up as soon as you started speaking, so that's been really helpful for me. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I read the article even now last night about the, was it another 500% chicken release in the Tamar? Well, I'm a fisherman in the Tamar. I catch eels, salmon, obviously bass is a bycatch. So I'm just concerned, you know, a lot of this food goes into the local food chain. So how safe are we eating from the River Tamar?
Thank you.
Okay, I mean, Patrick said to me, would you talk about tritium? And I said, it's a very controversial subject. Look at it this way. In 1978, this dockyard was licensed, certified to discharge a number of radionuclides into the marine environment. and to the atmosphere. On the basis of the certification by then the Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Pollution was on the basis of what was tolerable. They used to balance the detriments, the health detriments, against the benefits. What they'd finish up with was an equation that said, look, for every gallon of tritium or carbon-14 we push out, it's going to cost us £1 million to abate it. Yet the loss of life or health effect is only going to cost us £100. So there's a sort of cost effect goes on. Quite legitimate this is as well. Now the point I'm making is this, that way back in the 70s, the assessment procedures that were undertaken then drew a line under what was acceptable in health detriment terms against the benefits of operating this plant in this city. Now, nothing has happened that would change that equation, because the equation, the line was set to the plant, to the Devonport dockyard, not to the number of submarines. So when they come along and say for operational reasons, for matters of operational safety and security of these submarines when at sea, and because we're running these cores for a much longer period, we have to store the tritiated water on board, bring it back home. Nothing has changed to say why they should be able to discharge more tritium. So once you've set the limits, unless your information about tritium says, well, it's not as harmful as we thought it was, in fact, the evidence is the other way, it's more harmful, then the limits should not be expanded. So there's something fundamentally wrong with the authorisation process that enables the limit to expand with the nuclear activity. And now you, as a fisherman, you would be one of my critical groups. You're critical in two ways. First of all, you are probably a net handler. You handle your nets. So you're going to be contact exposed. You're going to be respiratory exposed as well, because you're breathing near water, vapours coming off your nets. And you're probably a fish eater, more so than your neighbours. So you'll be a part of two critical groups. So you should be a benchmark for tritium and the other exposures. And you have to consider these not just on our own, but in respect to the other radionuclides. And we know that carbon-14 was grossly underestimated at the dockyard. I think the whole situation needs a review. If you were to say, if you were to ask a question about tritium, where would you put it on the scale? Generally, it's put very low down on the ranking of radiotoxic materials. And tritium, by the way, is hydrogen. There's a lot of work being done now on the interaction of cellular material. One of the problems is with this type of technology, because it's such a specialised technology, the nuclear industry, when the authorisers need information about what's the best abatement technology, what's as low as reasonably achievable, these are the criteria that are used under the Radioactive Substances Act to limit discharges, they have to go to the industry to ask the industry, well, what is the best abatement technology? What is the as low as reasonably achievable? And it's only the industry that can actually provide those answers. So there's a problem, and tritium is produced in all nuclear processes, and it's a difficult one because of the volume you have to handle. You can filter it out, it is possible, but it's very expensive. So there's a question mark on, should the authorisation certificate have been revised? The answer should be no. Is there a need to limit it even more? The answer is probably yes. And is there sufficient independent research on the abatement technology and the interactions of health detriment? And the answer is probably no.
Thank you. I've got some four more people I'm going to take. We are looking to wind this up at 9 o'clock, so I crave your indulgence. But John will come back again as the last voice. There's somebody here had their hand, and this little, yes, there's a woman there. Well, while you're going round, Patrick, can I just draw your attention, particularly our friend at the back? There is a copy of the latest research on tritium that was highlighted as saying that it was twice the risk, the carcinogenic risk, that was previously recognised. Now, it's quite a technical document, but the conclusions are very clear and very much there, particularly tritium being a risk to pregnant women and to young children. And I think that we can use this to start to build up a body of information. What I will say is this...
You must put it in context, right? Let's stop it. You can't... Saying tritium is twice the risk. Twice the risk compared to what? Iridium?
No, sorry.
Compared to cobalt.
So what it was
And that's the problem. Where does the risk fit in the entire equation of radioactive exposure? And where does it fit in terms of its biological interaction? And where does it fit in terms of the age and habit and occupation of groups? These are very, very complex systems. How does it work its way through the biology, the ecosystems to come back? You can't simply say, oh, it's twice as bad as we thought it was before, because the impact of tritium, and I don't know, might be just represent 100-fold of the total impact. So it now represents 150-fold. That's the difficulty of taking the isolation.
Thank you. I'm going to have one last crack, because the point here was the Environment Agency, when this report was released, said they had taken it into account in their deliberations last year that led to the government increasing the threshold by 700% in the amount of tritium that could be released into the atmosphere. I read in the Herald, along with you yesterday, that actually the Environment Agency said they only wish they had had the information, and that the Plymouth University had bothered to give them that information, and why wasn't it being released. In other words, that really they're changing their story as more and more information comes online, and I think we should be deeply suspect of all these organisations at the moment. Now, I've got four more, I'm taking them. There's a woman just here who's been waiting very patiently, and then I'm going down.
You say that these safety plans are in fact a red herring, in that you can't make it safe and therefore you shouldn't even pretend. I mean, are they a pretense? Are they a way of making people feel better?
No, there is a responsibility to mitigate. But the current approach is based on the fact that you can predict what accidents and what events will happen. And this falls down because accidents by their very nature are accidental. And if you take into an accident, a malfunction is an unintentional, unintelligent event. If you now introduce September the 11th into the equation, you're now introducing an intelligent, intentional attack on the system. And the problem is that even warships have never been designed, to my mind, to look for this type of intelligent, intentional attack. So that's the weakness. In terms of what can you do? Well, instead of working on the probabilistic risk, tolerable risk, acceptable risk, tolerable consequences type of approach, it might be better to concentrate on consequence management. So to say, yes, these accidents can happen, but we will put in a system of managing consequences. Now, that may be a more common sense approach to managing accidents. And the real thing is for transparency for members of the public to feel confident that those in charge and administering the technology are providing themselves with sufficient data. And what REPA does is it transfers this responsibility from someone to someone who doesn't have control of the technology. So Plymouth City Council is not in control. You don't expect your emergency planners here to be nuclear scientists. And that's the problem. It's this gap between the operators, the Royal Navy and DML, and the emergency planners. And I'm unhappy about that gap.
Thank you. Yes? And then...
Yeah, just to say, I'm a teacher in Plymouth, and in the last 6 months, I took it to our head teacher to find out about safety plans in the event of an accident. And schools are not able to do very much, because we can just get in touch with health and safety at the LEA and get told, we got told that there would be a new plan and it wasn't going to be very different to the last one and it would be absolutely fine. Now, hearing your presentation this evening has been very, very useful in terms of looking at that, giving me more information about the higher risk accident and trying to find out whether that will be covered by the new plans. But having been told that the new plans are just going to be relaunched, the old ones relaunched, it gives me something to go back to school with. But I guess this is a bit of a campaigning meeting, and I guess that a heck of a lot of people around here are involved with children who are at school. And I think it's a very good place to start, because, you know, iodine tablets aren't very good anyway, but even if you had a whole cupboard full of iodine tablets at home, your children are at school a lot of the time, you could find out all the things, you know, you could do for your children at home, but there is a chance that an accident could happen when they're at school, and then there are people like me that will be shaving their hair off and putting them inside as soon as I can and showering them down. But I'll probably be about the MBT through my school doing it, because the others will be driving home to their own kids and I haven't got any to drive home to. So I really do think the schools are a good place to try and address this issue. And it's quite important that people who are actually concerned with the children going to the schools do that. Take it to your PTAs, take it to your parent meetings, go and see the head and that sort of thing. And this evening has really helped us to look at the plans that come out with some sort of, with more, I feel more informed now, because I just didn't understand this 2 kilometre business. My school's outside of it, so we have no, you know, the issue is not addressed at all at the moment. So sorry if that was a bit garbled, but I do think, you know, it's the highest risk, really high risk category within my mind.
Representing BR6 as a maximum type of accident, of course, the severity would work up to that.
Yeah.
But there's nothing to say, there's no law that says that severe accidents can't occur at the same frequency as less severe accidents. And if you drop a dinner plate, it breaks, and that's a fairly frequent accident. So the problem with REPA at the moment is this funny line that says councils will consult with bodies and members of the public as they see fit or appropriate. I think it would be proper for members of the public to press for proper consultation. Because when you read DevPub Safe, there's going to be one example of DevPub Safe. There's about 10 years ago, I negotiated for the firefighters, the National Union of Firefighters, the limits of radiation exposure for firemen attending nuclear incidents. And it was agreed nationally with the Home Office, that firefighters, their single event dose will be no greater than 50 millisieverts, 50 units of exposure. And at that time, at 50 millisieverts, any member of the team of firefighters would withdraw, and all other members of that team would withdraw because they've used as their coordinated units. So if they wants to plan it, in an emergency, at 50 millisieverts, firefighters would withdraw. Another firefighter would go in. In DevPub Safe, it says that emergency services personnel will receive radiation exposures up to 1,000 millisieverts, with no consultation whatsoever, to my knowledge, to the Fire Brigade Union on this. So that's the difficulty of this scheme. Now, whether your local planners, your local emergency planners, I think they're genuine in their want to actually provide this training. Whether they understand the complexity of that is another matter.
To the Reverend, representing Plymouth Friends of the Earth Group, thank you very much for a most interesting and, I have to say, rather disturbing presentation. It's been very interesting. It's obviously a very, very complex subject, and it reaffirms my feeling. Many environmental groups and other groups in Plymouth and individuals pressed to have a public inquiry when we heard that the consents were going to be increased for certain radionuclides. And it's very disappointing that we never had that public inquiry, and that's the only comment I have to make. Thank you very much.
Right, can I just say to you, up until five or six years ago, nuclear power stations, say at Hinkley Point, were considered to be separate nuclear power stations. So Hinkley Point A was considered separate from Hinkley Point B, and they both had their individual discharge licences. The NII, Nuclear Installation Inspectorate, saw sense, and so did the HMIP, the Environment Agency, and said, single plants, the site, the nuclear site, has to have a single licence. So all your nuclear power stations have got single licences. This place here, it started off with 4 submarines, it's now got 20 submarines, plus the decommissioning halts, and yet they're all treated quite separately. They're treated as single units, whereas clearly it should be treated as a single site. And as I said, you've got the equivalent of a large nuclear power station inside a city. totally unacceptable on planning requirements. There's a principle used in nuclear planning called the Farmer Principle, which gives you a relationship between risk and population density. And Devonport, you mentioned in 64, when it was being site selected, scored with six different places: Belfast, Chatham, Devonport, Rosyth, Faslane, etc., were scored, and Devonport got 22 points, and the worst case was 24 points, was Belfast, but Devonport was reckoned to be second worst, if I remember so correctly. And even the Royal Navy, the, what's called CNNRP, the Naval Nuclear Regulatory Panel, argued against ships' maintenance that Devonport was unsuited as a nuclear refit dockyard. They even went to the UKAA, United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority, and said, if we use this dock, can we build a sealed shed to refit the submarines? And the UKAA said, no, no, that wouldn't be effective. This is unsuitable because of the proximity of the population. And they argued against it. And if you get these documents out of the Public Record Office, you can see the Royal Navy's regulator itself said, if Devonport is ever accepted as a naval refit dockyard, there will be a change in reasoning in nuclear safety. And that's what's happened. And it happened in 78, and I'm afraid by the introduction of the Vanguard class submarines and the Astutes that are coming in, it's another change now.
Thank you very much. There's two more. One, the gentleman right at the back, Patrick, the very last gentleman, and then the last.
Suspended particles. So if you do a plot across the British Isles, you find there's a peak that runs down this west, all along the west coast up to Scotland, in fact, drops off in Scotland. There are a number of factors. There may be habit and lifestyle factors, maybe population, migration factors, and so on. So it's a very complex type of comparison has to be made. I'd be rather worried about a government agency that made such a simple comparison then simply dismissed it. So it needs a lot more reasoning.
Thank you. Final gentleman.
Hello, I'm Richard. I'm involved with Plymouth Triton Ploughshares Group, and Triton Ploughshares is a group which in Scotland has organised quite a lot of non-violent direct action in resistance to the Triton system up there. And we're going to be helping to organise a camp down here in November and various other events in between now and then. But I wanted to ask John a question, and this was specifically about Triton. If you could outline what's going to be happening with the Triton subs at Devonport over the next 8 to 10 years briefly, and specifically as regards the fuel bots being removed from the subs and going elsewhere and coming back and all of that kind of stuff. And someone told me, I wonder if you could clarify this, that they couldn't find any engineers to remove the fuel bots from the Vanguard subs because all of the nuclear engineers in Britain had exceeded their radiation dose or something like that. So it's just if you could comment on that as well.
Okay, good. Look, the nuclear powered submarine like Vanguard, the Vanguard class, what happens in the generation of nuclear powered submarines is you develop the reactor core to last longer and longer and longer. And the idea ultimately is to match the refuel, the need to refuel the reactor, to the need for a major refit of the submarine. And the optimum period is about 12 years. And the latest cores, the reactor cores are in Vanguard class, and the new Astutes, will try and match that. So the submarine will come in every 12 years. This one, the first one's always a bit shorter. Every 10 to 12 years for its refit. What happens in a refit is you do all the bits and bobs for the rest of the submarine, the steam plant, you modernise all its weaponry equipment, so on and so forth. The reactor is allowed to cool down. That's physically cool down in temperature, and also to drop down some of those very volatile radionuclides, like the iodine. Iodine-131's got a half-life of about 3 months or something, and it dies off pretty quickly. You allow the radionuclides to cool down. You then literally flood the reactor compartment, take off the cap, remove the fuel remotely. The fuel then goes into a pond, which is stored in the refit centre, underwater. They've got a licence, I think, now to store up to 2 cores on site. The core stays there for another 2 years or so to make sure all the iodine is out. It's then transported up to British Nuclear Fuels at Sellafield in a transit container. It takes about 4 journeys at the moment to actually ship 1/4 tonne of fuel in modules. The container weighs about 120 tonnes. It's called a TN-17 for the sort of anorak spotters. And then when it gets to Sellafield, it joins 27 of its mates sitting in fuel ponds, and nothing else happens to it. It can't be reprocessed. It's not the only plant that could possibly be processed was Doon Rae, and it can't handle it. So the fuel comes from is the primary fuel before it goes in the reactor is manufactured at Capenhurst near Liverpool, where it's enriched, where you enrich the natural fissile component, the U235, which is 0.7%, up to 93.7% or thereabouts. Capenhurst does the first 60%. The fuel is then sent to the United States. It's then finally enriched in the United States and it comes back to the UK.
How long will
the stuff be here? Oh, sorry, the refit period between 2 and 3 years.
And when do the refueling bots come down?
They usually leave the reactor in situ cool while they're busying themselves on bits for about a year. It's usually a couple of hundred days if they can get away with it. So there's a dwell period where nothing happens. But the sort of risks I've been talking about were operational reactors. And the sort of risk of a submarine, a major incident involving a submarine while it's during in dock in berth, is a different order of magnitude. And the type of severity are different types of accident. What you'd be looking for there are criticality accidents where the reactor starts up automatically on its own, and you have something called a fuel ejection, where you eject the fuel rods out because it becomes supercritical. And then you have a fire and a release because your containments are not in. So there are accident scenarios, but I haven't looked at those tonight. I've just been concerned with the rate. What happens at the end of a refit? The Navy, God bless it, takes command of the boat. And this is another factor, is that because DML is a civil installation, the NII, Nuclear Installations Inspector, control the operations of anything on the dock side, but the submarine remains under control of the Royal Navy. While it's in the dock, it's a black box as far as the NII are concerned. When they finish refueling, the submarine then is pulled off to another berth in the dockyard, number 7 berth, I think it is, and then she goes through a full power range testing trial, where she's taken up to full pressure, run at full power in the dockyard, and that's again an area where you're looking at major accident risk. But at that time she's got new fuel in her, and sorry, it's a she, she's got new fuel in the submarine, and that means that the fuel is not that radioactive, so what you're looking for is short-lived isotopes coming out. So there's all different types of scenarios you can talk about.
Thank you. Look, I'm going to bring John back in for a last word in a minute. I want to thank you for your patience, and particularly I want to thank you for all the contributors tonight who've made some very important statements and asked some very vital questions. It would be ridiculous to suggest that we could have one meeting of a couple of hours long where all the questions are answered. It's raised more questions than it's answered, and that's a symbol of just how important and how big an issue this is for our city. We need to ring the alarm bells. The first time I read John Large's work was in 2000, which is what alerted the trade unions, the Plymouth Trade Union Council and Unison to the issues. In his another report that actually said that there is a calculable risk of a 1 in 80 chance of a Chernobyl-style nuclear meltdown in Plymouth Dockyard in the next 30 years. That was before September the 11th. That was before the added risks that John's talked about tonight, and that was before becoming a vanguard. That is unacceptable, and I think everybody needs to go away and make sure that we ring the alarm bells loud and clear. Can I say, there are stalls and a bookstall outside. Please don't just run away. Please do look through the publicity and the materials outside. There is plenty of the information that you've heard tonight outside. If you did enjoy it, if you did get something from tonight, please do give financially, generously. Tonight did cost money, and the campaigns that you've heard about are going to cost a good deal more. Please do sign up to the coalition, the Nuclear Free Coalition as well, by making sure your name and address is on the yellow sheets outside the door. Again, reiterate, write to your MPs and councillors as soon as you can, raising the issues. You don't have to be a specialist or an expert or know it all. Raise the questions. And I think that the issue of the public inquiry, which we have all been campaigning about for the last few years, is something that should be at the bottom as a demand in every letter that goes to the newspapers and to the politicians, etc. Remember that there is a programme of activity that we're all involved in, all the different campaigns. The 10th of August, Saturday the 10th of August, there will be a protest march starting at the Peace Gardens at the Hoe and going up to Devonport. On the 12th of October, CND is hosting a national demonstration in this city, which we hope you put in your diary now and make sure you bring half a dozen people each to. But there will be people coming from across the country to say this is an unacceptable risk here and anywhere. And of course there's the Trident Ploughshares Peace Camp in November. Interspersed along those will be more public meetings and more information. Please do get involved. Please do help us in any way you see fit or you feel you can. This is the biggest issue for Plymouth. There are lots of others. This is the big one, and we've got to protect our children's futures. The last word to John. Thank you very much.
Thank you. What I'd like to say is this, that my experience is, if you put a case, then it's very easy to slip away from what the other side quotes are doing. In my experience, the Royal Naval officers and the men who operate the submarines and the engineers who prescribe their conditions and operation have nothing but the best intent to maintain safety. There's no doubt in my mind about that at all. So what you have, perhaps, is a misunderstanding of what is an acceptable risk. And it's up to the public, in my mind, for you to be satisfied that the risk that the Royal Navy and DML and the great sort of hierarchy of inspectorates, the risk that they are prepared to take on your behalf, is fully understood by you and is acceptable to you. And that's really what you need to know. You need to have a degree of transparency that enables you to accept the risk that others are taking on your part. And that's what I'd like to finish on. Put it in perspective, then everyone involved in the operation of the nuclear power submarines, of course, is not planning to have an accident. It's that I think you're in the dark on what they consider as an acceptable risk and tolerable consequences to the citizens of this city.
Thank you.